Take me where the promise is.
An AA meeting. My name is Pat, and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday 8 p.m. Blue Chip Speakers meeting at the NABA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more of sobriety tells his or her story. This reading is based on a passage from 29 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Each individual in our own personal stories describe in their own language and from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope that no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on aabluechipspeakers.org we'll hear our speaker, and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing themselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. I'd like to introduce the speaker before he comes up. There's a bunch of people that are here that I haven't seen in a long, long time. I can't wait to hear what he has to say to bring everybody out. So come on up.
Hey everybody, I'm Jack. I'm an alcoholic. Thanks for everybody coming out. I'm an alcoholic, and I'm a happy, vigorous member of the 130 Think It Through Sober group. And I see a lot of friendly faces out here, and I appreciate y'all. This is late for the 130 group. And I want to thank Tim for all his tremendous service over the years and doing this meeting. Unbelievable. And thanks, Kat, for sharing. So it's good to be here. I meant to say, I hope everybody got a donut that wanted one. And I started bringing donuts because I was in this club. I got sober in Pensacola, Florida. And there was a clubhouse much smaller than this, and they had donuts on the counter. It seemed like everybody would bring a donut from time to time, a box of donuts, and I figured, well, shit, I better bring some donuts. So I brought some donuts one day, and the guy who became my sponsor happened to see that. And that's what kind of gave him the idea that maybe I was worth investing some time with, because it showed a little bit of willingness, and you know, some willingness to be a part of, I guess. And he saw that, and you know, and he helped me so much that I'm eternally grateful for that. So I like to bring donuts from time to time to meetings, just to remind me of that. And a little sugar goes a long way in AA, as you know. So, and, you know, I mean, the longer I'm here, the more it is, this is all about willingness, you know. Unfortunately for me, I had to be driven, you know, as all of us do, or most of us do, we had to be driven to become willing to try to get sober. I know for me, I was a, you know, blue-collar kid, middle-class kid, went to high school, did pretty well in high school. Got a scholarship to a nice university, and overall you'd say, oh, this is a, you know, this is a kid who's going to do some things. He's going to go somewhere. He's going to be, or at least he's not going to be, you know, a criminal. But my junior year, I went to a party and had 3.5 beers. And that changed, it literally changed my life. I mean, that feeling of euphoria and release from self that I got from that first drink, I believe I pursued the rest of my drinking career. And from that point on, I was not interested in doing anything that didn't involve beer, you know, or Southern Comfort. If we're going to movies, we're going to a football game, we're going to a show, a play, hanging out, whatever it was, and if somebody was having a keg party, I was attending. So I pursued that feeling because I was wound a little tight. Some say I'm still wound a little tight. And I was perfectionist, still have that perfectionism in me, you know. If I can't do it exactly right, if I don't know exactly how it's going to turn out, I don't want to do it at all, you know. I had an authoritarian dad, and he was, never quite good enough. So, man, that release from that, made alcohol very attractive to me. And so I pursued it. And once I got to college, that was like, okay, now I can drink every day. And I did, everywhere there was a party, I got a job at a restaurant, cooking so that I could have some spending money, and I was next to the tap. I got a job at another restaurant, and I was next to the tap. And I drank pretty much every day from the time I got, to college till the time I got to AA. Which wasn't that long, 11 years or so. But if I wasn't sick or, in jail, I went to jail a few times, not that often, but if I wasn't, reeling from a serious bout of alcohol, I was drinking. And I was drinking my fill. That's the thing. I always wanted my fill. I wasn't intending to get hammered every time I went out, but I was chasing that line. That little perfect mix. So sometimes that was 8 or 9 drinks. Sometimes it was 13. Usually it was like somewhere in the middle. It was like 12 and a third. And I wasn't leaving that glass unfinished, so I was always going over the line. And once I went over the line, who knows what was going to happen. So I eventually went from sort of the dean's list at my university to a short order cook to being kicked out of school to working on the railroad to getting back into school, getting kicked out again, and having no place, and being evicted. I came home one day, and all my shit had been thrown out from the third floor window onto the lawn because I was a financial disaster. I mean, I was making money, but I was always spending it, on drinks. So, I would make the rent usually, but not always. And then when I'd get behind, and I'd be borrowing from Peter to pay Paul, and I'd have, back then we wrote checks, and I'd always have the one check, it didn't quite clear in time to get the other check to pay, and then all the other checks would start tumbling down the hill. And then every one of them was like a $25 charge, so I was always in the hole, and I was always pissing people off because I wasn't paying them back, or I wasn't paying them back timely manner. Getting thrown out, my roommate was not happy about that. So my life became. I started to burn through all my relationships, burn through all my family, borrowed all the money I could from them, and began to pay it back and then stopped. All my friends, everybody was like, I'm not sure I'd want you to live with me, Jack, because the last time all your furniture got thrown out of the window. So one day I had this big blue vinyl suitcase and I packed it up and toted it out to the highway. My friend dropped me off, actually, and hitchhiked to Florida. Someone had made the mistake of saying, yeah, you should come down. So off I hitchhiked to Florida and showed up on their doorstep. And, you know, and you think after all of this, you know, as these consequences start to mount up, you know, we start to think a little differently. But I always thought, first of all, I mean, I coveted the ability to drink. I mean, I wanted that more than anything else. And I just thought, as many of us do, I just need to practice a little more. You know, I need to get a little better at it. Because, you know, I don't have ill intentions. You know, I'm not trying to get in a fight. I'm not trying to lose another girlfriend. I'm not trying to, you know, get disenfranchised from my family. I'm just trying to get my fill. And so I went there, and, you know, I was one of these guys that would, you know, I'd drink till a catastrophe happened, and then I kind of, you know, wake up, shake it off. I try to get my shit together, you know, be more vigilant about how I drank. I try to get my life together, and so I'd move. I'd get a different job. I'd get a new girlfriend. I'd get a new you know, country, and I went to Mexico one time trying to do that, and and I try to get my act together, I'd kind of pull it together, I'd get another job, I'd be doing all right, but then slowly but surely I would drink like I wanted to, and slowly but surely I'd become persona non grata, and so it got worse in Florida, of course, as it does. I was managing a liquor store, so, you know, I was always somewhere near, you know, the resource, and so I'd go be in the back cooler, managing away, my life was just unmanageable. Couple of good examples of that. I bought this car. I didn't have a car for a long time. I bought this car. It was a 1964 Buick Electra 225. And but the radiator leaked. And it just started to leak a little more and a little more and a little more. And so I had these milk jugs. I had like 8 of them that I carried around in the back seat. And you know, the radiator light would come on, I'd jump out of the car, pop it off, and dump a bunch of water in there, and close the hood. But I never got the radiator fixed. Not because I didn't want to, not even because I couldn't afford to, because I did not have time in my busy schedule to get the radiator fixed. I did the same thing with my taxes. And believe me, when I say this, I needed this money. I had a W-2 form come in. I'm always broke. I needed this money. I filled out the form right away, put it in the envelope, and never got a stamp. I was always going to get that stamp the next day. That thing sat on my, you know, corner table in the bedroom for 8 years. I did not get it. I did not file those taxes till I was 3 years sober. And they still paid me the money. How about that? That was amazing. So I was unmanageable. And I'd be out all night. I would go to jail from time to time, mostly for sleeping in the car. You know, I drove drunk every day and never got a DUI. But I would pass out in the car, you know, get in the car, I'd be driving to another bar or a liquor store or just pull over on the side of the road and start to think about what I was going to do next, and I'd just sleep. And the police would find me, off I'd go to jail. And those would be DUIs today, for sure. But this was back in the 80s. So MAD was just starting to get together. Man, I did not like those people. Then one time I managed to get married. I got a new job. I was selling liquor now. Now I was a salesman. So I was putting on parties at bars every night, and my wife worked at the same company, and she went right along with me. So we were just partying away, having a great old time, and we got married, and she was like, okay, you know, and this is how I imagine it. In her head, it's like, okay, time to be an adult now. And she started being an adult, and I kept doing what I was doing, and she didn't understand it, and I didn't understand her. You know, how come you're no fun anymore, you know? And she's like, how come you're out every night till 4 in the morning? Well, not out every night till 4 in the morning. I'm out till like 1 or 2, but I'm coming home and sleeping in the garage, because I would do that. I would get home, and I'd pull into the garage, and I'd sit there and go, now, what is my excuse? What is my story for being out till 1 o'clock or 2 o'clock in the morning again tonight? And I would just fall asleep. I'd pass out, and, you know, I mean, I was broke. I'd gotten a job as a stockbroker, so I was managing people's money. Be careful. So I'd have this suit on, and I'd just fall asleep, you know, on the brake, you know, or on the floorboard. And we lived in Florida, and it was August, and it was 108 degrees in that garage. One morning, I just walked up the stairs and said, you know, of course my wife was pissed. And she was like, and I was like, call the treatment center. You know, like this big declaration, call the treatment center. we'd be sitting there watching TV and the treatment center commercial come on, she'd turn up the volume. So I went to treatment, got introduced to AA, and, you know, that's an expensive way to get introduced to AA, but I'm grateful for it. And they explained, I have this glop in my brain. When I drink, it activates, and it creates this desire for more, the phenomenon of craving. So that's what I have chemically, you know, and then I have this part of me that just loves to drink, so I want to drink. And once I start drinking, that glop kicks in, so you got a real problem there. I was like, okay, so I thought, all right, I'll go to AA. So I started going to AA, and I started to learn a few things. The first thing I learned is these people know about drinking like I know about drinking. They know some of the really dark little tricks of the trade that we know. We know about, like, I used to love to drink all night and then get the newspaper and go to a diner and sit there and drink coffee and eat an omelet. And I just love that solitude, you know. And there are people that did that. I used to run this route, you know. I'd go to this one bar that was a nice bar, and I'd go to this little kind of crappier bar, and then I'd end up the night at this really, really dumpy place, you know. And there were other people that knew about doing that, and they just knew about sneaking drinks. I was always sneaking drinks. So they had a little credibility in terms of, you know, I didn't think you were all actually sober. I mean, I did not believe that. You know, I thought, yeah, they're out there nipping on the side a little bit, coming back in and saying how good they are. But because I didn't really truly feel it was possible, you know. I mean, I just thought, I mean, somebody had 3 years sober in our meeting, and I thought, that's just crazy. 3 years sober. But they had that credibility, and so maybe what they were saying was okay. And then I went to this meeting, and this guy said, listen, we are not the temperance society. We are not against drinking. If you want to drink, please be our guest. Nobody likes it better than we do. But if you're interested in stopping drinking, this is how we found that it's worked for us, and we're willing to share that with you. If you don't like it, do whatever the fuck you want. You know, there's other ways to get sober. Go to the church. You know, climb a mountain. My brother ran his car into an abutment on a railroad. And that kept him sober for 3 years. You know, so, and me being defiant, I'm like, well, if you're telling me to get out, then I'm staying. And I like that. I like the fact that nobody's selling anything here. You know, if you want to drink, have at it. But if you don't want, if you want to stop drinking, if you've had enough, then we'll show you what we're doing and how we're doing it. And maybe it'll work for you. And that was attractive to me. So I started coming. But, I mean, for 90 meetings in 90 days, are you crazy? That's too much for a busy guy like me, the World Series. This was in September. I went to the treatment center in August, so this was mostly September of that year. And you know, there was football that just started, the World Series, baseball playoffs were on. You know, I had things to do. So two meetings a week was enough for me, and I'm a smart guy. I can read this book, and I'll decide what's appropriate for a guy like me. But you know, I don't mind dipping my toe in the water a little bit, and I didn't mind stacking the chairs and cleaning the ashtrays. By the way, I think this is a great advantage that people like me had getting sober. We used to have to stack these chairs up at the end of the meeting, and we had to clean the ashtrays because everybody was smoking. And that helped, you know, I did that, so I guess that's part of that willingness. But it keeps me around after the meeting, and people would notice, or they'd tap you on the back and say, glad you're here, hope you keep coming back, you know, what's your name again? Kind of thing. So, you know, if you're new, if you're just coming around, find an excuse to just stick around for a few minutes, you know, let somebody reach out to you, or you actually reach out to somebody else. And that's how I started to get some phone numbers. And I can't emphasize enough, for me, getting phone numbers was the single most important thing that helped keep me sober. It's easy today, y'all. Everybody's got a phone in their pocket. We used to have to go to the phone booth, you know, and dial. So, you know, it was crazy. But, you know, calling people and just telling them. I mean, I would just admit, I feel like drinking. They're like, me too. And so, you know, because we were both in that, you know, short-term space, we could help each other, you know. So if you're new, get with somebody who's also new. Y'all can save each other's life. Because I would call somebody and, you know, talk to them. And then because I had called them, they'd call me back. They'd call me sometime. And they would save my life when I didn't know my life needed saving. I don't know how screwed up I am. And I really didn't know how screwed up I was when I was new. You know, because I thought, well, you know, yeah, I was messed up when I came in here a couple days ago, but now I'm all right. And 6 months ago, I was messed up, but now I'm in good, you know, I know what's happening. And when I got a year, I was like, I was insane when I had 6 months. But I pretty much got it dialed down now. So we grow. You know, we learn. And it gets better. So, let's see. Yeah, so making those phone calls was important. And but like I said, I was doing it my way. I was going to do it Jack's way. Because I was a little smart, I'm arrogant, you know, is one of my main character defects. And I was arrogant when I walked in here. Because I knew a little more than you. I wasn't quite as bad off as some of you. And, you know, I could figure this stuff out. And you got to be careful how much you're trying to put on me, especially this God stuff. And so I was doing it my way. I was going to 2 meetings a week. I was doing the book myself. And, you know, I'll take it from there. Well, I got on the phone because I'm really smart. And I said, Ma, I understand now that for me, to drink is to die. So have a good day. And within 45 minutes of saying that, I was guzzling a bottle of Irish whiskey. So, and then off to the races on a really bad relapse. Not a long one, but a really bad one. And so I'm grateful for that because I learned, first of all, the circumstances were that I could only have that one big jug. And then the way it worked out, I had to go brush my teeth and pretend like I didn't drink anything and get through that night. And then the next day, I got through that day. But, man, I had turned that switch back on. When I turned that switch back on, holy shoot, it comes on. And so I went to a meeting. And I said, gee, I don't know what it is, but I just really feel like drinking. And that's how honest I was. They said, oh, chair the meeting. You know, you'll get a lot of good feedback. So I did, and I went straight from there to the bar and off on a major bender and, you know, and ended up with a case of whiskey in my car, all my clothes in my car. My wife was screaming at me, throwing me out of the house. I was going around writing bad checks, trying to collect as much money as I could. In cash, because I was making a break for it, and I was going to Chicago, and I went through this light, and I had a moment of clarity, and that clarity was, wherever you go, you're taking you with you, and I pulled off by the side of the road, got a motel, $14 a night motel room, and just drank that case of whiskey, and flopping around like Dan Aykroyd in Trading Places. But I came back, and I managed to, you know, do that for about a week, and then I came back to AA and picked up a white chip. I had a half a bottle of whiskey left. I gave it to the maid. And because I was that kind of guy. And I went to this AA meeting, picked up a white chip, and drove straight to the liquor store. And I picked this up from the guy who would be my sponsor, and he used to say, just say, God, please relieve my alcoholism. So I was sitting in front of that liquor store saying, God, please relieve my alcoholism. Let me not drink at this liquor store. I'll drink at the next one. So I backed the car up, drove to the next one. Said, God, please relieve my alcoholism. Help me to not drink at this liquor store. I'll drink at the next one. And I did that for 3 hours all over Pensacola, Florida. I mean, I went to every bar, every liquor store. I kept pulling up, backing out, pulling up, backing out. And I didn't know what I was doing at the time, but what I realized sort of today, it was really the first time that I was like, God, help me. And don't help me by fixing my whole life. Just help me do the right thing in the next 30 seconds. You know, and I've learned that that's a valuable thing that I can use. You know, if I can just break something down and get started in the right direction, that helps me in all kinds of ways today. But so I managed to not drink that day. And by the way, the good news was the feeling passed. And I was astounded. Because whenever that feeling came on before that I have to drink, it was like, it must be satisfied. You know, I must be satisfied. And I just capitulated to it, you know. Well, it's, you know, that's how I feel, so that's what must be done. So getting through that day and realizing that if I could just not wet it down for 5 more minutes, eventually it would pass, was news to me and miraculous. So that remains the most important day of my life. It's October 12th, 1986. So, I got through that day and I've been sober ever since. And, thank you. And I've been part of this thing, you know, since then. And I learned a lot, but what I mostly learned from that relapse was that doing AA's Jack's way ain't working. So I had to come back here and do AA's way. And I didn't even sort of realize that, but I kind of did, and I started going to a meeting every day. And I broke down and got a sponsor, which I thought was humiliating. I thought hanging out with you people twice a week was humiliating enough. And now I'm asking this guy to help me. That was rough. But it turned out to be the best thing, you know, the best decision I ever made, because he was really good at just letting me know that all of my craziness was normal, you know. I thought I was the only one thinking like this. I thought I was the only one defective in some way. So when I talk to newcomers today, you know, when you're absolutely batshit crazy, I get it, you know, that's how we are, especially early on, and sometimes later on. So he, you know, he told, you know, he said, you know, look, whatever you put before, you know, your sobriety, you're going to lose. This has to be priority number one. This before your wife, before your dog, before your mom, before your siblings, before your friends, before your job. This has to come first. And since that day, I have to say that's maybe the one thing I've really done right. I do understand that alcoholism, for me, is the number one thing. It's my defining characteristic. I was grateful, eventually, to find out I'm an alcoholic. I know why I'm so fucked up, you know. It was, you know, that was good news. And it accounted for a lot. So it's good, and it's good when we can come in here. What I love about AA is when we come in here, when we're just walking in this room, we're all sort of saying, yeah, well, I'm kind of fucked up too. And we all just sort of admit that we don't know everything. We're not the brightest bulbs burning, maybe. Maybe we got issues. But it's okay, you know? And we're all more human for it. And for a perfectionist guy like me, that was some of the same feeling I would get from alcohol. You know, you see so many people, they come into an AA room, they exhale. I'm with my people. I can feel better. So my sponsor was like, "This, you have a window of willingness." And I see this all the time. You have a window of willingness. Take advantage of it. You know, while you're willing, get busy. Do some work. Start to make some changes. Go to 90 meetings in 90 days. Get started on the steps. And he was like, "I'm not your real estate agent. I'm not your banker. I'm not your lawyer. I'm not your taxi. I will help you through these steps, and you will get sober. I'm not going to get you sober. You will get sober through this process." And that's been my experience. And that's what I give people I sponsor, the same speech. And they do the same thing that I did. Not because it's the best. Not because there's some sort of secret super sauce to it. It's because that's what I've experienced. That's what I know. So I had to get on the God train. I had to figure out what God was. And because my sponsor was great at sort of explaining this recovery in a logical way. We're like, "Oh God, that's beyond my logical brain, my analytical thinking." And I kind of always, you know, I sort of had a belief in this nebulous thing called God, but I was mostly dodging it, you know, and just trying to hide out so it wouldn't notice what I was up to. But his logic was, "Hey, if you admit you're powerless," and I had just gotten done proving I was powerless. I was in this motel room with my life just collapsed around me. If you are powerless, then there better be a power greater than you. That's the corollary. If you are powerless, there better be a power greater than you. And the genius of AA is, we don't care how you figure that out, what concept you have, it just better be greater than you. And believe in something other than your capabilities. And that made some sense to me. So we got to step two, and I was like, "Oh," and step three, and then it seemed like, "Oh, geez, that's a big, you know, bridge to cross. You know, it feels like, you know, I'm going to get zapped and transformed, and I'm not sure I want to be zapped, you know, because I didn't want to get too good." You know what I mean? I want to be, you know, a little shady still, you know, but better, you know, but not too good. And he said, "Jack, the less you know about God, the better." And I was like, "Whoa, what?" "Yeah, the less you know about God, the better. And by the way, nothing happens in step two." "Really?" "Yes. You come to believe in the possibility of solution. Maybe this thing will work for you. You may be restored." And restoration meaning a process over a long time in which things get done. Shit, bad shit gets taken out. Good stuff gets put back in. So nothing's happening there except that you're coming to believe that maybe this can happen for you as well. And step three is, I think we shall look for it. We shall seek power greater than ourselves. And that's what I like about it. That's my favorite word and how it works. God could and would if he were sought, not found. And that has always helped me. Because I'm not going to figure out God. It's beyond my pay grade. I don't know if it's a guy in a big white coat, or the force, or, you know, the lake, whatever. You know, what I do know is I am incapable of understanding it. That, you know, God is, you know, as somebody said, a beautiful mystery beyond human understanding, including the concept of being and non-being. So I was like, whoa, you know, what does that mean? It means that you can't figure it out. So quit trying to figure it out. And just move on. And see what happens. And I think that's what happens, is we don't figure out God. We experience God. And that's what's happened for me. I've experienced a higher power working in my life. And what I do is I seek that power. How do I seek that power? Well, I show up at these meetings. I talk to other alcoholics. I read some literature. I say a prayer. You know, I ask decently, you know. But I do reach out and make an effort, take some action to sort of let the power see, I'm trying, you know. I'm making an effort here. And what's happened for me is that power has shown up. You know, I didn't have to sort of, you know, I don't know. It's not like I plugged right in. I'm more or less, I went through a dial-up modem, you know. And then over time, it's become sort of a T1 line kind of thing, you know. So he helped me a great deal in that, because he pointed out, and I think it's page 62, and I bought hook, line, and sinker the bit about selfishness, self-centeredness, that's the root of our problem. I read that paragraph, and I was like, yeah, that's me. I get that. I buy it. Because I was absolutely like that. And so we have to be rid of that selfishness. We have to, or it kills us. God makes that possible. And I was like, oh, that's why it has to be a God thing. Because I can't cure a problem of self-will with more self-will. And that's what I've been doing my entire drinking history, which is trying to cure a problem of self-will by exercising the hell out of my self-will. I would pound the table. Pound the table. I am not drinking today. I'm not drinking today. I'd leave my office. I'd get to this light. It's in Fort Walton Beach, Florida. It was a tea. Been there? So if you turn right, you went through a dry county and you got one right to my house. If you turn left, you were in the bars in Fort Walton. And in the center lane, you could turn left or right. Every day I got in the center lane. I'm turning left. So I was powerless. So I need power greater than me. What else did I want to talk about? So we change. So, you know, with God's help, if I can sort of tap into this thing that I don't understand, but if I can go through this process, I begin to change. Very quickly, I'll just kind of zip through that, you know, I had resentment, and my sponsor let me know that resentment is to feel again. I walked around with all of this stuff that I had done while I was drinking, and whatever I happened to do that day, I went into a store, oh shit, remember when I used to steal from that store? You know, I ran into an old friend, oh shoot, remember when that guy's girlfriend, I used to run around with her? You know, all of these memories and these things would come up. So writing that stuff down in step four, getting out of my head, allowed me to not think of that and think of it all day long, every day. So making that and then starting to see that how I caused my own problems, you know, and beginning to chip away at that, repairing some damage, and then repeat in step 10. And then trying to increase that contact in step 11. I'll tell two quick stories, and then I know I'm running long. But those of you in the 130 recognize that behavior. First thing is, I was selling, I was making a sales call, and I used to sell, so I was selling financial services at this time, yet another job. And I had two products. One I sold to government employees, knew that product backwards and forwards. One I sold to colleges, really didn't know that one very well. So I had an appointment at a college. And I got to the parking lot and I thought, shit, I don't know anything about this product. They're going to make fun of me. They're going to ask me questions. I'm not going to know what's going to happen, what they say. And they're going to, you know, just laugh at me and not buy anything. So I know. I'll call up. I'll say, I'm having car trouble. I'll go home. I'll study up. And then I'll come back. And I'll be all smart and they'll buy everything. And that's my whole life, you know. Run away when it's uncomfortable. Escape. And I said, God, please help me to get out of this car. And I don't know, I got out of the car. God helped me to walk through that door. So I walked through the door. It happened to be the final day for the deadline for those people to sign up. And they didn't care what I had to say. All they wanted was the forms. And they're like filling out the forms, and so I just walk out of a stuffed briefcase full of all this sale, you know. I set the record for sales in my company. The CEO called me up to congratulate me. I was in the newsletter and asked to do training courses for other people. And so, well, I remember being back in that car, and I was like, how many times in my life did I not get out of the car? And that is how I stop myself. And I am the impediment. And so I have to, so if I can break that down into small things, God, help me to get out of the car. God, help me to dial this phone. God, help me to write one sentence. All that stuff seems to tumble out and work. All right, the last thing is, 2.5 years sober, I was in Panama City, Florida on a sales call, and I didn't like anybody. I didn't like my wife, my dog, my neighbor, AA, Al-Anon, anything, you know. I was fed up and angry. And I don't even know why. I can't even tell you what was going on, but I was there. And I was like, I'm 100 miles from where I live. I'm going to get drunk. Nobody will know. I'm going to get drunk. But I had enough AA in me to say, all right, I'll go to this one meeting. And I mean, this meeting was out in the, I mean, like 10 miles outside of Panama City, like in what would look like a one-room schoolhouse, you know, with a little brick building with a little light bulb in it. And I thought, geez. So I said, but I'm going to drink after this. So lady was talking about how she was grateful because even though they turned off the electricity, still had water to give the baby a bath. Somehow my problems didn't feel so bad. And right about that time, this guy from my own group walks in. And you can call that what you want. But this is in the middle of nowhere, 100 miles from where I live, and he walks in there. And so instead of me going to drink, he and I went out for coffee and bitched to each other about whatever was wrong. And, of course, 3 days later, the whole world was great, you know. So what I learned is do one more thing. Do one more thing. Because sooner or later, you're going to have that moment where it's like, you know, we get to fuck it. We don't like, you know, we just get frustrated. And it's mostly frustration. do one more thing, make one more phone call, go to one more meeting, read one more, say one more prayer, do one more thing, is what I learned out of that. That's the second most important day of my life. Well, I've gone on long enough. Thank you all for coming out.
Thank you, Jack. Now I know why everybody came to support you, to listen to you. You're awesome. Thank you one and all for joining the Blue Chip Speakers meeting tonight.
First I slipped and then I crept to a hope-filled dream. You rescued me and finally waking there I see. I look into love's window for a soul that's meant for me. Takes me where the promises are real. Sometimes quickly, sometimes slow, we get just what we need. On a broad highway, stride for stride, we walk eternally. For a heart that beats for me, takes me where the promises are real. Take me where